Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about restorative justice. And our guest for the program is someone who is acknowledged to be the founder and of the contemporary restorative justice movement, someone who is well known as a practitioner, writer, lecturer, and teacher in the field of criminal justice. His name is Howard Zaehr. He's professor at Eastern Mennonite University, where he co-directs the Center for Justice and Peace Building. His books include, among other things, Changing Lenses, A New Focus for Crime and Justice. And he makes the argument that when we think about crime and the criminal justice system, in as much as we may talk about victims, crime really is a violation of the state. It's a violation of the state and its laws. And the justice system establishes blame and it administers punishment. But what many people argue is left out is the victim. And we'll be talking here about what restorative justice is all about. And in essence, it is an effort that concentrates on victims, asking questions like, who has been hurt here? What is it they need? And who is responsible for meeting those needs? He will be here in Champaign-Urbana next week for a number of events. Let me just mention one of them. This will be taking place next Thursday, the 6th of November, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He'll be talking about restorative justice, what it is, why it works, what it can mean for us. It's a free public lecture. There also will be an opportunity to ask questions. This will be at the Spurlock Museum and the Knight Auditorium. It's 600 South Gregory in Urbana on the U of I campus. Anyone who is interested certainly is welcome to attend. This is in part sponsored by the folks at the First Mennonite Church on West Springfield in Urbana. There will also be some events at the church. I will mention those later. And also for people who are here listening to the program, questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and also toll-free, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, people want to come into the conversation, that certainly is welcome. We just ask people to try and be brief in their comments, just so we can keep our program moving along and get in as many people as possible. But, of course, anyone who is interested should feel welcome. Professor Zaehr, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
It's nice to be here with you.
You know, I'm interested just in a way of starting with this point that I tried to briefly sketch out here in the introduction. And that is that, you know, in as much as many people argue, particularly people who argue for strong justice, what they see as a strong justice system, they argue that it should be about victims. That is, people say, well, we spend an awful lot of time talking about the rights of the accused, and we should be considering the victim. But you're really suggesting that you look at the system as it is, and in fact, I think that you would say the way that the system is actually structured, there really isn't much of a place for the victim. It's not really about the victim.
That's right. It's the state versus, you know, Timothy McVeigh in the Oklahoma City bombing case. So it ends up the victims have to go to Congress to get the right to sit in on their own trial. There are several problems. As you said in your introduction, the crime is defined against the state, and so you have to sort of add victims in as a footnote because they're not part of the equation. It's crimes against the state. It's state versus offender. And so they're left out. Another problem is that the process is so adversarial that it's very often re-traumatizing to victims. And the third problem, I would say, is it just doesn't give victims very many choices. We assume that what victims want is punishment of offenders, and some do, and it makes sense that they would. But that's a very, very meager list of options. What I find in my work is that victims have a whole series of needs. And there's a cluster of needs that I call justice needs. And if those needs can be addressed, victims can move on their journey much easier. And it's when those aren't met that people often get stuck. So what restorative justice is trying to do is provide a whole menu of other options for victims and allow them to have more say in defining what those needs are.
Mm-hmm. I suppose some people would question the question the use of the word restorative.
Yeah, that's a questionable word.
And would say that, you know, it's in so many, if we're talking about a very people who have suffered a very, very serious crime.
That's right.
I'm sure some people would say, well, there is no way for this person to be made whole again. So,
that's right.
So even to talk about restoration, they might say, well, maybe the impulse is good, but you better even find another word because it just can't be done.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'm afraid I gave the field the term, but we still haven't found a better one, but it's a very flawed term because it suggests going back, and you'll never go back. Even if you get to a point that you feel you're whole, it isn't by going back, it's by creating a new world. I did this book called Transcending Reflections of Crime Victims, where I interviewed and did portraits of victims of severe crime around the U.S. and Canada, and I asked almost all of them what the language was. And of course, it's not closure. I mean, your closure is one kindly grandmother said, say closure, I'll give you a black eye. But I asked Lynn Shiner, whose children, Jen and Dave, were killed by her ex-husband on Christmas Eve. She went to pick them up on Christmas Day. They were divorced, and he had murdered both of them and killed himself. And she says, well, none of those RE words work because I can't go back. She used the metaphor of a ladder without rungs. It's like I'm trying to get up this ladder, and I have very little of my old life to use in that. So the reword is a problematic word, and it's led to a lot of misunderstandings by victims of what restorative justice is about. Mm-hmm. But we haven't found a really good replacement for it, I'm afraid.
And I suppose some people would argue that they might even grant the point that the justice system, the way that it's set up, really isn't about the victim. It's about establishing guilt and meting out suitable punishment.
Right.
And it's about punishment. It's about holding someone accountable for the actions. And I suppose that is supposed to be the satisfaction that the victim has seeing that happen to the perpetrator. I suppose that some people again might say, well, this idea that victims have needs and we're not taking care of them, that's fine, but are you asking too much of the justice system to say that somehow that's something that you would expect it to be able to do?
Well, the problem is, though, that we do all this to offenders in the name of accountability, but it has nothing to do with genuine accountability. Think a little bit about how offenders do what they do. They do it by having all kinds of excuses, like all of us do when we do something wrong. We have all kinds of stereotypes, rationalizations, and offenders do that all the time. Well, I've had burglars say, I went into the house, I turned pictures around, I didn't want to think about it, I hurt the person, or, you know, they had insurance, I'm sure, I didn't hurt anybody. They have all kinds of excuses. That's how they do what they do. Mm-hmm. Then we put them in a system, as a judge friend of mine says, a central premise is put the state to the proof. Make the state prove it. So your attorney says, plead not guilty. So it's as if we developed a mechanism to reinforce the very denial strategies that offenders were using to do what they do. And then we put them in prison where there is no culture of taking responsibility. What restorative justice is trying to say is, yes, let's hold offenders accountable, but let's do it in a meaningful way. You ought to have, to the extent you can, you ought to have to understand what you did to somebody and take responsibility for it. And so restorative justice has been built around several key premises. One is that victims need to be more central. A second one is that offenders have to be held accountable, but in a meaningful way.
Give me an example about how, at its best, restorative justice could work.
Well, there are a variety of programs called restorative. Unfortunately, the term has gotten so faddish that everybody's calling everything restorative justice. So it's hard a little bit to sort out what's really restorative justice. I would say the core programs allow victims and offenders to meet one another either directly or indirectly. There are a variety of other restorative approaches that don't do that, but in some ways the ideal scenario is that victim and offender are given the option of meeting together, a safe space is created, the victim gets a chance to say to the person what they did, to put a face to the boogeyman, to ask the questions they have, the offender hears it, and begins to hopefully understand what they did and then do something to put it right in some way. Some kind of agreement. And sometimes they're very surprising. I mean, I could tell lots of stories. This is probably too long a story. One case we had, for instance, back in when I used to live in Indiana. I grew up in Illinois, by the way, central Illinois, but I moved to Indiana. I was in junior high. The city commissioner and his wife had been burglarized, and they were pretty upset about it, as you can imagine. But through the courts, we brought the two young men back to meet with them. And as they began to talk with them, these young men began to understand what they did, and the victims began to feel better about the process. And they said, well, what we want out of this is, for your burglary, we want you to buy a piece of furniture to replace the damage, a piece of furniture that will fit the decor of our house. They had two goals in that, they said later. One is they wanted these two burglars to have to know them well enough to know what would fit in the house. And the second was that they wanted to be able to tell their friends that their burglar bought this piece of furniture for them. Well, the funny thing was that they had Asian furniture, and there weren't very many places in the county that that sold it, and they ended up going shopping together. Now, it didn't all happen this way, but, I mean, sometimes they're really surprising things. They went shopping together, and then a couple months later, the woman is walking down the street, and she runs into one of these burglars, and that's partly why we need to do this. In our communities, we do run into each other, and she asked him how he's doing. He said, well, he had just lost his job. She said, well, what are you going to do about it? And he said, well, I'm going down to this factory down here. I'm going to apply. She said, oh, I know the owner. I'll call him up. She calls him up and gets him a job. I mean, that's an ideal kind of scenario. They don't all happen that way. Yeah. Sometimes people just come out. I always figure even if they don't end up friendly, the statistics say that victims, there's a study, a big study was done out of England looking at studies around the world and found that there was substantially reduced trauma on the part of victims after they went through this. They even told the British government that if you would do this on a system-wide level, you could reduce health care because of the clear evidence of decreased trauma, increased satisfaction, and so forth. That was a long answer. Sorry about that.
No, that's fine. I like the story. I guess my reaction is, or I expect a lot of people would say, well, okay, I can see how if we're talking about, sort of a low-level property crime, vandalism, burglary, so forth, I can see maybe how that would work out. But that if you're talking about something, someone who was raped, someone who had a family member murdered, to confront the perpetrator, I would think, might be so traumatic that it would be difficult. I'm not sure whether that would be possible for the person. And I suppose then you're also asking for someone to have to have an almost superhuman ability to overcome what would be maybe the natural first impulse was, which would be wanting to hurt that person back.
Right. Yeah. Well, when we first started doing these, we did a lot of burglary because they were experienced as a violent crime. When I interview burglar victims and assault victims and sometimes even rape victims, until they tell me what happened, I sometimes can't tell the difference. They were serious crimes, but the system wasn't taking them that seriously. Mm-hmm. So that was a good place to begin. Today, I think as 24 states have programs in place for the most severe kinds of crime, for murder and rape and so forth. Most of those programs, however, are not designed to impact the outcome of the case, and most of them have to be victim-initiated. Some people want this kind of thing. Some people don't. Some people don't want it at first, and then they want it later. The reality is that the states that have these programs often have waiting lists, sometimes several hundred, waiting lists of several hundred people, survivors, victims who want to meet their offender. So it always has to be voluntary for victims to go through that kind of process. They have to be the gatekeeper on it. The timing of it may vary. They have different kinds of goals. I co-facilitated a serial rape case in another state a while back, and the woman, when she went into it, she told me, all I want to do is tell him what he did to my life. I want him to know my descent into drugs, the breakup of my marriage, my unemployability, all of that. And she did that. But when she got in there, she also had questions. She had said to me, I don't have any questions. But when she got there, she went, how could you do this? How you assaulted 14 young women in a year's time. You had no prior record. How could you have done this? So we went through that process. And later, at the end of the meeting, I said to her, you know, you've waited a long time. She had come from another state. And you've come a long way. Are you getting what you wanted? She had a little piece of paper she'd written down, which we'd have suggested she do, her goals. And she looked at her list and said, you know, I've gotten everything I want, and I'm at peace now. It wasn't that they became friends. He told me later, it's clear she didn't forgive me. But it was also clear, and I talked to her later, that it made a huge difference in her life, that it allowed her to address her needs. And that's what it's ultimately about. It is not, there's been a lot of misconceptions that restorative justice is about reconciliation or forgiveness. And it's fine if that's what they want to do, but that's not what it's about. It's an effort to address victims' needs, hold offenders accountable, involve those who are impacted by a crime in the resolution of their situation. If they choose reconciliation, forgiveness, that's up to them. But it's not what we're trying to do with it. We used to use the language of reconciliation around it. We realized that that was really misleading and counterproductive.
In that, going back to that particular case that you just told the story of the woman who had been raped, and it was someone who was a serial rapist and had confronted that him.
Yeah.
Did you come away with the feeling that as a result of meeting with the victim and hearing what she had to say, that the perpetrator, that this changed him in any way?
You know, at the time, we were a couple hours into the meeting, and she said to him, "You stole my childhood." And he began to tear up, and he told me later, he said, you know, I've been through a variety, he'd been in there 20-some years, he said, I've been through all the therapy programs, he said, I never got it until today, what I had done. He said, because when I was a child, my mother left me, my father began to beat me, I realized that I had lost my child, and that's childhood, and that's what I'd done to her. And so in afterwards, he told me, he said, this is the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, but I feel better about myself than I have in a long time, and I'm ready to meet the other ones if they want to do that. Hmm. Ironic, it seems, paradoxical, but I found with many serious offenders feel a sense of responsibility and don't know what to do about it. And the idea that maybe even by letting the person vent to them, that they might do them some good is meaningful for them.
We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus 580 with Howard Zaire. He's professor at Eastern Mennonite University, where he co-directs the Center for Justice and Peace Building. He is someone who is well known as the founder of the Contemporary Restorative Justice Movement. He was appointed by the federal court to work with victims in the Timothy McVeigh trial. He also serves on the Victim Advisory Board of the U.S. Sentencing Commission to oversee sentencing guidelines. He's going to be in Champaign-Urbana next week, spending a few days. A number of sponsors to his visit, including the First Mennonite Church in Urbana. He'll be speaking at 4 o'clock in the afternoon next Thursday, that's the 6th of November, at the Spurlock Museum of the Knight Auditorium, or in the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum on South Gregory. On this very topic, he'll be talking about the subject, restorative justice. It's a free lecture. Anyone who is interested is certainly welcome to stop by and to hear what he has to say. Questions here on this program are also welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Just as someone who is a Mennonite, I guess maybe it's not too surprising that you might be drawn into doing this kind of work. But let me just ask you how it was the case that you do this, and that you're known for really not being the only person who argues for this kind of approach, but one of the first perhaps to argue for this kind of approach.
Yeah, it actually the literature widely attributes the beginning of the movement to a particular case in Ontario, Canada that was started by two Mennonite guys, a probation officer and another one, trying to figure out what to do with this case of multiple vandalism, and knowing that the victims would be left out and not get anything out of it, and the offenders would never understand what they did. And back in 1974, I think there is a resonance with the Mennonite faith. On the other hand, we often don't practice what we preach. We aren't as good at resolving our conflicts as one might expect, but I suppose that's the reality of real life. But it's probably not an accident that it came out of a And then it started in Indiana also among Mennonites and then quickly spread. And, of course, today it's far beyond that, and it's not, most of the initiatives around the world are not faith-based and all of that. But it did more or less come out of the Mennonite community, although what I've found is that it really connects with most traditions. I teach in an environment where we have people from all different faiths from all over the world, from African and other traditions. There are practitioners that come from these countries, and many of them find resonance with their own tradition, both their religious tradition, their cultural tradition, even their practices. Often they will say, well, this is what our grandparents did, you know, before the legal system came in and said it was a bad thing. So I think there's lots and lots of connections, but the immediate movement did happen out of the Mennonite community, I think.
Mm-hmm. What's the reaction to for people who are in the justice system, law enforcement, judges, prosecutors, people like that?
Well, it varies. On the one hand, some people are really skeptical. If you have a very punitive attitude, it may be harder for you. Prosecutors often define their job by numbers of convictions and so forth. On the other hand, there are an awful lot of people in the system who realize what they're doing isn't working. Corrections people who are saying, you know, we cannot build ourselves out of this. The former commissioner of corrections in Pennsylvania, who's now, I think, in Washington State, used to say that building prisons is not going to solve crime. There is no correlation between imprisoning more people and the crime rate, and certainly the research seems to bear that out. So there are a lot of people, there are judges and prosecutors who say, I'm just frustrated with what I do. I was just remembering a story the other day. We helped a number of cities in Russia start programs a number of years ago, and when the group in Moscow went to the prosecutor to tell him about this, he said, look, you might as well not take your coats off. I don't have time for this. As they began to talk, they couldn't get away from him because he began to realize that he had been assaulted, and he was very frustrated at how his own legal system had dealt with it. And he got more and more intrigued. So, yes, there's resistance, but there's also a lot of people who are looking for new meaning in what they're doing, for new answers. So you find both reactions.
Mm-hmm. What other, when you've talked, I'm sure, with a lot of people who are victims, who have been victims of crime, and perhaps you could talk a little bit more about the kind of things that they talk about wanting or needing or looking for that go beyond simply seeing the person that was responsible punished.
Right. Well, there's five what I call justice needs, five clusters of needs that I keep hearing from victims. I mean, there's lots of needs that people who have been victimized have. Some of them they have to address with their therapist and their loved ones and so forth. But there's five categories that I say are justice needs that I keep hearing. One of them is need for safety. They want to know that the steps are being taken, that this not happen to them or other people. They know there's no guarantee, but they want those steps taken. One of the interesting things is that when they come out of victim offender meetings, they often say, you know, I think maybe it's a little less likely this person's going to do this again, and that's satisfying because they want safety at any rate. Second is information. They want answers to questions. Our research all over the world says you want to know why me and why you picked my house and why you used an axe to get in the door and what were my daughter's last words and there's one, you know, what was my son doing on the bridge the night he was killed? Was he doing something wrong? I mean, they have all kinds of questions because they're trying to put their world back in order. A third thing they need is a chance to tell their stories. People who work with domestic violence call it truth-telling. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission of South Africa knew this well. You need to restory your life. You're trying to incorporate that terrible thing that happened to you into your own story. And the way you do it, for many people, is by telling your story. So you need chances to tell your story and have it validated and listened to. Another set of needs has to do with empowerment. When someone breaks into your house, they've taken power over you. When they hold you at knife point, they've taken power over you. When you can't get them out of your head, when you have these dreams and you have these feelings of anger and so forth, you often feel like you're out of control, like this offender is still ruling your life. So another category is a need for empowerment. And the last one is the most complex and the biggest one, and that is what I call the need for vindication. when something like this happens, we need to be vindicated. And there's some different dimensions to it. Part of it is we're trying to have this sense of humiliation we feel replaced by a sense of honor. So many people who work with victims say what you're trying to do is restore your life from a story of humiliation, humiliation of being a victim, humiliation at the way you acted at the time and so forth, to a story of honor. But there's a more basic thing. I think that there is a basic need for reciprocity. I often say if I give you a gift, you will probably think you need to give me a gift back, or you'll do this calculation in your head about why it's not necessary. I think the need to exchange Christmas gifts and the need for restitution or revenge come from the same place. We need to balance the score. And culturally, we keep being reinforced that the way to do that is by revenge. But often things like restitution and apology go a long way, because what you want is you want someone else to take responsibility. You want to know you're not to blame. You want to know that the other person gets it. You want the other person to do something and make it right. And you don't want it to be too easy. I mean, you want it to be a difficult thing. So it's a complex concept, but I think the basic need for vindication is underlying a lot of this, and we have been very narrow in the options we offered for getting vindicated.
Well, and I guess I guess just trying to put myself in the place.
Yeah.
And imagine how people would feel. I guess I can say that the most serious crime I've ever been a victim of was, I don't know, about 25 years ago, somebody broke into my apartment and stole my stereo system.
Mm-hmm.
That's I can say I'm lucky to date. That's the, you know, the worst thing that's happened to me.
Yeah.
But if you imagine, I can imagine, say, for example, someone killed a family member of yours.
Yeah.
And they had the person, they established beyond a shadow of a doubt that was the person that was responsible.
Right.
And so say you brought the offender and the victim into the room, and there was a gun on the table, and you said to that person, okay, if you want to, you can do it. You pick up that gun, you shoot that person. And I imagine there are some people who could do it, and some people who maybe could get themselves to the brink of doing it, and maybe some people who would just be horrified at the
right.
thought. But that I would think that the initial impulse and one that you'd have to fight with yourself over would be to do it, because the drive for
yeah.
for vengeance would be so strong. And maybe actually I'm underestimating people by thinking that maybe more people would actually want to do it or would have to argue with themselves about it than not. And maybe also I'm thinking, you know, my idea of what would be considered to be compensation. Maybe I'm thinking I'm limiting how I would think about that. I'm only thinking about the proverbial eye for the eye, I guess.
Well, I think it's natural for us to feel that way. I think anger is a natural response. It's a healthy response. So I think all of those kind of responses, we have to be very careful about judging people for them. The other thing is that, but I think that we have been culturally trained to think of vengeance as a way to address that. Given that that's true, then it is a natural response for a lot of people. If you were right from the start to the time the crime is reported, if we did everything we could do to meet victims' needs, try to get, you know, instead of while this case goes to this court and the attorney is telling you, please, person not to plead not guilty and not take responsibility, and the victim's frustrated and left out, and the victim doesn't know what's going on the defense side and all that, by the time they get to the point where they might meet, they're often really angry because they have been so mistreated and so left out of the process. But imagine a system where right from the start we began to work at the victim's needs, where we tried to reduce the adversarial nature of the process, and I can give you some case examples of that if you want, and trying to meet their needs, and then at some point said, now, would it be helpful to meet this person? I mean, in the state of Pennsylvania, the Department of Corrections Victim Services routinely tells victims of severe, serious crime now, early on, now, if there ever comes a time that you want to meet this person, we have a program for it. Most of them aren't going to want to do that early on, but at some point, many people come to the point where that's what they want to do. But I think the critical thing is addressing those needs right from the start. Whether an offender has been caught, I have a friend that used to be head of the National Center of Victims of Crime, and she used to say to me, I'll believe restorative justice when there are restorative options available, even when the offender is not caught or it isn't appropriate to have go through a process. And I think she's absolutely right. I think if we're really designing a system that would be restorative, if we want to stick with that word, we would be meeting victims' needs of all kinds of needs right from the start. She actually argues for what she calls parallel justice. She's so pessimistic that we could ever reorient our justice system away from its exclusive focus on offenders that she thinks we need to build a separate justice process for victims and then just have like a ladder links between the two from time to time.
We have a couple of callers. I want to get them in here. And also, we're a bit past our midpoint. I do want to mention again that our guest, Howard Zare, who is professor at Eastern Mennonite University, where he co-directs the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding, he'll be here next week, spending a number of days here in Champaign-Urbana. His visit, in part, is sponsored by the folks at the First Mennonite Church in Urbana. I want to mention again, he'll be giving a talk about restorative justice Thursday the 6th at 4 p.m. in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. On Saturday the 8th, he'll be doing a workshop on restorative justice, and this takes place at the First Mennonite Church. And anyone, registration is not required. It's free. Anyone who would like to attend can do that. And also, he'll be speaking at the church on Sunday, 9:15 in the morning. He'll speak during worship. And again, anyone who is interested is welcome to attend. You also might, if you're interested in reading on this subject, you might look for his book, Changing Lenses, A New Focus for Crime and Justice. That will tell you something about what restorative justice is all about. We have a couple of callers here. First up is in Decatur on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. Fascinating, a very provocative topic. Trying to put my arms around it. There's so many different directions we could go with this. Just a couple of observations, maybe a quick question I'll ring off. My mother, long since passed away, but literally almost 100 years ago, she was in grade school. And if the child misbehaved, did something wrong, she always tells me the story that the kids were sent home first to apologize to the parents, because the children didn't realize that, you know, whatever their actions were, also, you know, was a reflection on the parents, and they should realize, you know, their deeds and the impact that their deeds had. I just thought, well, you know what, that's not a bad idea. I mean, the world has turned over many times since then, and I'm sure that would never be enacted again, but I think what your guest said as far as people not realizing the impact of their deeds. And then the second thing is I had my brother-in-law's, about 15, 20 years ago, this is a crime of happenstance and opportunity, which I think would just drive the victims and the parents of the victims crazy. They lived in Colorado, and the young man went outside to take target practice, and circumstantially, there was an ex-convict. The ex-convict was in the area. He took the gun away from the young boy and shot him and killed him.
Oh my.
And, you know, you play this over in your mind. You know, what if Johnny stayed home that day? What if, you know, Johnny had a glass of milk instead of going out? As it turned out, the ex-con was wounded by police, and they ended up putting him on the same hospital floor as the young man who was shot. And this so enraged the parents, of course, they moved the convict. But I just think so much of this crime is one, I think, perhaps opportunity, and then I think the most dangerous situation is when a convict absolutely has nothing to lose and, you know, you shoot somebody, whatever, it doesn't matter because, hey, I'm a lifer, what's the difference? Just a few observations. I'd be interested in your comments. Thanks.
Oh, well, that raises all kinds of interesting things. First, on their story about your grandmother, I think basically all we're doing is going back to those traditions that we've lost. That is, being encouraged to take responsibility, to apologize for what we've done, to try to make it right. Many of our parents and foreparents did this. When I speak at Rotary clubs and stuff, people come up and say, you know, that's perfectly logical. That's what my parents did when I did something wrong. But somehow we've gotten ourselves away from that. In fact, I would argue that we're basically a culture of not taking responsibility. Very few people ever apologize. When they apologize, if you analyze it, it's not a real apology and so forth. So I think you're right. I think we're basically going back to some values that we have held in the past and that we're in danger of losing. Your other story raises lots of issues, one of the issues being the brutalizing nature of prison. Unfortunately, what happens, so the prison is such a traumatic place to be that it often makes people worse, and then we release them into society and expect them to somehow be good neighbors, and that's a whole other area of problem. You mentioned about putting both of them on the same floor, the victim and the person who did it. And, you know, one of the problems with the system being so offender-oriented is that it really doesn't understand much about victims. I do a lot of presentations for lawyers and prosecutors and judges and law enforcement around victims and what they go through. And I find that they really don't understand that very much. It's partly why I did the book Transcending State of Pennsylvania, for instance, put it in all the prosecutors' offices just to help them understand that better. And so what happens is that inadvertently they do these things, these disrespectful things. A friend of mine was in court. Actually, he was there representing an offender, but he had worked with the victim as well, and they were trying to it was a woman whose daughter had been murdered, and they were trying to reset a date, and they set this date for the new hearing, and she began to scream and cry, and the judge literally threatened to find her in contempt. And my friend went up to the judge and said, "Judge, you're trying to set that date on the date of her daughter's birthday." He knew that, but the system didn't know it. I don't think that prosecutor and judge had intended to be so harmful or disrespectful. They just didn't know because they're not really oriented around the victim and their needs.
All right. Well, I appreciate the questions of the caller. We have someone else. This is Champagne, and we'll go there next, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Very interesting topic. Just a couple things as someone who has worked mental health and then the domestic violence field as well. I think that, first of all, how to put this without coming off as some sort of flaming something or other. We need justice. I think that's right. The first thing is in our society.
Yeah, I agree.
As Americans, in particular, although I'm sure this is true of many other cultures, there is such a bias towards socioeconomic status, and that's why I want to be careful not to come off as a flaming whatever. Until you work with people who have grown up in the south side of Chicago, say in the Cabrini Green area, which I, as a teacher's aide 2 years ago, had the pleasure of doing. I mean, people are people. And you talk to a kid who has two bullet creases and a couple star wounds because of a drive-by, you don't understand that justice is not there for that person. And so I'm not saying that justifies their criminal behavior, but it certainly explains it. And then when it comes to victims, I think, especially in the field of domestic violence, the system, I don't want to even say fails, because that would imply somehow they're trying to meet the needs of the victims. It just, they're obliterated, is perhaps the best thing I can say, in that when it comes to, say, something as simple as supervised visits, where a judge will say that the offending parent, the alleged offending parent, let me be careful, has a right to visitation with the children, but there is no provision for the state to step in and provide those services.
Yeah.
What ends up happening is the alleged non-offending victim parent is the one who ends up supervising those visits, which is just crazy. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. So again, I think restorative justice is a good idea because it's saying we're all part of a web, we're all part of a system, there are no neighborhoods, we all live in the same town. But I think we need to even go farther down than that in the chain of things to make sure that there is justice or balance before then. So thank you for this topic, and I'll just listen to you. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Well, I think you've made a number of important points. I think we do need justice. And people take justice in their own hands if they don't get justice in some way. That's the reason the state is given for taking over That's what political scientists call them, a legitimate monopoly of violence. One of the problems, though, is what it demonstrates. You know, the justice of the street that you described is tit-for-tat justice. You do this to me, I'm going to do this to you. It's gotten worse in the last couple decades around that. And unfortunately, that's the message, many people say, of the legal system. It says, you do this to me, you harm us, we're going to harm you. And it reinforces, as James Gilligan, psychologist, has said, it reinforces the very behavior that we are hoping to reduce. And so that we do need justice, and when there is not social justice, it makes many people feel like that they don't buy into the mainstream justice system, and so they often feel like victims, which raises a whole other issue about the way offenders often are acting out of a sense of victimization, which we could talk about if we want to take time for it. You mentioned about the part of the web. I think the underlying value of restorative justice is a reminder of our interconnectedness. It's something that we tend to lose in our individualistic society. One of the reasons that so many traditions in the world resonate with restorative justice is that's where they come from. They come from a basic understanding that we are interconnected. What I do impacts others and vice versa. And restorative justice is based in that assumption that we need to find ways to call us back to that. At the same time, there is an awful lot we don't know. I often say we're still very early on the learning curve of restorative justice, and there is just an awful lot we don't know, especially about how to apply it in the context of the modern complex world. You know, it's a very simple idea. It's not rocket science. But when you start applying it in this modern economic system, institutional system, it gets all kinds of very interesting actual real-world problems. A colleague of mine and I did a book a while back called Critical Issues in Restorative Justice, where we asked 30-some authors around the world who were involved in restorative justice to point out the dangers and the problems and the challenges and what we need to be doing about it, because I think we are really early on the learning curve yet.
We have maybe about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Howard Zaire. He's professor at Eastern Mennonite University, where he co-directs the Center for Justice and Peace Building and is well known for getting the ball rolling in this movement, the Contemporary Restorative Justice Movement. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone else. The caller here is in Gibson City, not all that far away from us. Line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Mike, I have a couple questions. Restorative justice, as a state, are you familiar with Illinois and if we're using it in any of our court systems? And also, people around the world, are they using our court systems? And is there a way that you know that we could make this at least United States, a way of dealing with victims? And I'll hang up and listen, and thank you.
Well, Illinois actually has been really pursuing this in a major way. They have been having conferences, supporting programs. There's a judge in Cook County, for instance, and there's a lot going on in Illinois, and I could, offline, I could tell you who to contact who's coordinating all that. There are conferences and so forth. So Illinois has been doing a lot on that. So there are lots of things to look into there. Your other question was about around the world. Yes, there are many. It has really caught on. This New Zealand, and I've had the luxury of going back and forth there about every year or two. New Zealand is the only country in the world that I know of that has reoriented their whole youth justice system. They don't call it juvenile justice. They call it youth justice, around a restorative conference for serious crime. For serious crime, except for murder, you're supposed to go to a conference to sort out what ought to be done. And only if that conference can't sort it out is it supposed to go to court, or if the offender denies responsibility. Even for something like homicide, after going to court, they may end up in a conference. Now, it's a much bigger and more complex conference than many of ours because it involves not just the victim and their family or supporters. It involves the offender and all the family members, extended family, whatever, virtual family members, anybody they can get. It involves a police officer, because in New Zealand, the police are the prosecutors. It involves a special attorney, and then there's a coordinator paid by the state who calls the conference. And they are charged with deciding the whole outcome of the case by consensus, which is really interesting. They have to all agree. And they began with one of the highest youth incarceration rates in the world and dramatically reduced it through this kind of process. So they're the country that I think has institutionalized this more deeply than any other. But England has many, many programs around the country. Germany, I'm on the way to Norway and Denmark. They have various kinds of programs going. Australia has lots of programs. There are small programs at places even like South Korea. Some, one of my former students is working with violence coming out of schools in conjunction with 12 police precincts and offering victim-offender encounters in those kind of processes. So it is truly a global phenomenon at this point.
This gets at a question that I wanted to raise about how it is that you, within the justice system, you build some kind of structure for doing this, because I would think that there might be judges and prosecutors who would say this was a laudable goal, but I'm either right. We don't have resources to do it, or I'm not sure how we do this, or how do you, and does it take some kind of radical redesign of the system, or can you do this as something that you're going to add on to the already existing system?
Most of the programs in the United States are, in a sense, add on. They're an option out there. And they work out with a particular community, whether it's referrals from the prosecutor or from the judge or police or all of those. And then it may take the place of some part of the process, some part of the outcome. But they're not inherent in the system the way New Zealand is. New Zealand has actually institutionalized it. You know, we've taken the worst crimes you can imagine and developed a system to deal with them, and then we deal with all of them. What they have done is said, look, let's keep the courts for those cases where they're really needed, where people are denying responsibility, where the crime is so serious there are all kinds of public safety dimensions, and let's reserve the court for that, and let's use this other process for the rest of them. So in an ideal world, I think we would find ways to make the whole system more restorative. But most of the programs in the United States that I know of are more discretionary.
Mm-hmm.
And often some are operated within the system, some are operated by nonprofit organizations, community agencies, and so forth, that work in cooperation with the system.
Well, I think that's interesting, because there is such a concern about our court system being overburdened,
yeah,
and our incarceration systems being overburdened, whether this could actually be a way to take some of the burden off of that system, and that it could almost function as an alternative system.
Yeah, U.S. Sentencing Commission held a conference this summer on alternatives to incarceration and made sure that some of us were there to do a plenary on restorative justice. So they're pretty desperate, too, in realizing that restorative justice may have something to offer. Certainly in New Zealand, they found greatly reduced court loads. I had judges tell me that their workload for youth went down from 5 days a week to 1 day a week. They reduced the incarceration rate, but it was a core of the system. The danger in just adding it on as an option is that we either divert minor cases out there that we wouldn't have dealt with anyway, or that we just expand the capacity of the system. And that's what we often find. I think our over-incarceration of people, our pattern of over-incarcerating people, is more fundamental than we can address by just adding options. I was working with one community once that was taking kids out of jail, putting them through this restorative conference, but they found that the jail population wasn't going down. And when they analyzed it, they found that the jail was being financed by a per diem. And so when their beds were empty, they were soliciting the state for more clients. So we have to address those kind of factors that generate this huge incarceration rate.
Yeah. Well, this is not exactly new, but I think that some people would say one of the issues that we have to think about is that it seems that sometimes the way that we think about our justice system, that we've almost given up on the notion of rehabilitation. And
well,
we've given up on the idea of rehabilitation for adults, and we're on the verge of giving up on the idea of rehabilitation for children.
Exactly right. We actually, most states in the 80s and 90s wrote rehabilitation out of their law. They said, let's just punish people. So actually, while we still use the language of corrections, most of our statutes don't talk about rehabilitation in it. And so very little happens. And now with this cutback, state of Virginia, for instance, is just yanking They've had some pretty successful programs called therapeutic communities. And here in my own community, there's a community-based halfway house, which, interestingly, is highly supported by the community, which is unusual for a halfway house, but very supported by the community. They're getting all their funding cut because the state is tight, and so they're yanking money from the prison system, and the prison system needs this money to maintain its structures and its guards and its security. And so my understanding is therapeutic communities are getting cut, and the halfway houses are getting cut. And that's just tragedy. We're dumping, you know, thousands and thousands of people on the street every year with $25 and saying, go sin no more. That's just not very realistic.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that for people who are here, though, in and around Champaign-Urbana. Our guest, Howard Zehr, will be giving some talks next week. He'll be here for a couple of days. On Thursday afternoon, this is the 6th, at 4 o'clock, talking about restorative justice in the Spurlock Museum Night Auditorium. Saturday, November 8th, a workshop on restorative justice taking place at the First Mennonite Church. That's 902 West Springfield in Urbana, and it's free. And then he'll be speaking during worship on Sunday at the Mennonite Church, 9:15 in the morning. So those are opportunities if you're here in town where we are to hear from him. And also, of course, you can take a look at his book, Changing Lenses, A New Focus for Crime and Justice, or also the one that he mentioned, Critical Issues in Restorative Justice, which will give you some idea about what restorative justice is all about. Howard Zehr is professor at Eastern Mennonite University, where he co-directs the Center for Justice and Peacebuilding. Professor Zehr, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's been very nice to be with you. And if people want a quicker and cheaper read, there's a little book of restorative justice for $4.95 that I authored. And that's a lot easier to read than the other one.
All right. Very good. Thank you.
I'm looking forward to visiting Illinois again.